SpinQuest Social Casino. The presents are open and you're over the in-laws. It's a perfect time to grab your phone and play SpinQuest.com with live dealer blackjack, craps, and a ton of slots. And here's a great deal for the holiday, a $30 coin pack for $10. And if you're hearing this ad, you can play right now on SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Before we get started, just a quick note to say that some of the names in this podcast have been changed to protect their identities, but the stories you are about to hear are very real indeed. Please check the episode show notes for trigger warnings, as listener discretion is advised. If you'd like to share your story on the Affair podcast, please email our wonderful producers on affair@curvemedia.com. Welcome to the Affair podcast. I'm Anna Williamson. Now, if you don't know me, I'm a relationship therapist, coach, and TV personality. Now, this podcast will unveil the secrets behind modern day affairs as we explore everything from emotional affairs to rebuilding trust after betrayal. One in five people have admitted to having an affair, but it's a topic that is rarely explored and remains taboo because it sparks such powerful emotions and judgments. Each episode features a different real-life affair story told by the people involved and offers insights into the emotions, causes, and consequences of infidelity in today's world. From the motivations behind affairs to the impact on relationships, we'll uncover the raw truth behind one of the most painful aspects of human relationships. So, without further ado, let's meet today's guest. Joining me on The Affair with Anna Williamson this week is Mary. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's honestly, it really is my pleasure. And Mary, you have really quite one of the most extraordinary experiences around infidelity that I think certainly I've ever heard. And I'm pretty sure if I was a betting woman, I would say my listeners will feel the same. What made you want to talk to me today?
I heard one of your podcasts and I was also speaking to Naomi. Oh, I can never say your name, Naomi.
Producer Naomi. She's a legend.
It's
a team effort.
What a great podcast. What a great way to kind of explore the topic and actually to look into. So many people are shy about talking about affairs and being betrayed, particularly by a lover or being conned by a lover. And there's this kind of perception of idiocy that if you've been, if your partner's been unfaithful or anything else, that there's something deficient in you. When we first started talking, I mean, you asked me if I was happy to use my real name.
Yes.
And there is, a lot of people who don't want to because they don't want people to know who they are because they feel embarrassed or humiliated and stuff. And when I wrote my first book, people asked that same question, are you going to use your own name? Mm. And I think, there needs to be people that stand up and talk about this and say, this happened to me and I'm not ashamed of it and I'm not embarrassed about it and I did nothing wrong.
Hear.
And, that's something that, it takes people standing up and talking about it to be able to show other people that they've done nothing wrong either.
Oh, Mary, preach it and take it to church, sister. And, what a brilliant way to start this episode, because I know just from all the DMs that myself and producer Naomi get, how many people, the reason why I'm in, and forgive me for the small willy wave, we are now an award-winning podcast, but I think by the very notion of it being, this is the space to be human. Who are you within the typical pyramid of an affair?
Okay, so I was the wife.
Right.
The wife who
was cheated on.
Yes. Although I think we're going to have to ask that question again at the end.
Right. Noted. Noted. I know where we're going with this. But to set, because yours is a very, very twist and turny story. But I think, to set the scene for it, at the point of the relationship, at the beginning stages, yes, mm-hmm. you were the wife yeah. of somebody that then went on to commit some really quite unfathomable betrayals. So start at the beginning. So who was the guy? How did this relationship start? And fill us in.
Well, I was a single mum in 2000. My one-year-old daughter's musician father hadn't been able to cope with being a dad, so I found myself on my own. And I was a business advisor for the Scottish Enterprise Network. So I was a professional busybody. I used to walk into people's companies and tell them how to run them better. Great job. And I was really enjoying life. My daughter was at nursery. I had my own house, which I was paying my mortgage on. I had my own car. You know, I was quite settled. Early 30s, just getting on with life.
Sounds like a bit of a boss bitch to me. I mean,
and my friends were kind of going, oh, but you know, you don't have love in your life, you know, you don't have this, you know, love interest, and that was the only thing I guess that was missing. And I was under the impression that you were somehow missing out if you didn't have a partner. So this newfangled thing had come out called internet dating, and so my friend said, why don't you try it? What could possibly go wrong? Anyway, so I did. I dated about three guys, and nothing really came of it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of left it. And a few months later, I got an email from this guy who said his name was William Jordan. He was mixed race, American, had spent his life chasing his career around the globe. One of the things he said was he was infertile. He couldn't have kids because of about a month as a child. And because I already had my daughter, that was kind of ideal. So we met. Within 2 weeks, you know, he was telling me he loved me. Within 4 weeks, he asked me to marry him.
Eek, wow.
And I said no, obviously. It was way too soon. The relationship moved very fast, a little bit faster than I would have been comfortable with. But you know, just it was pulling me forward, that little, do you know what I mean? Sort of like it was pushing me forward.
Sounds like, you know, it sounds like just from the time period, you know, the classic love bombing. And would you say you were swept off your feet by this guy?
No, I'm an incredibly practical person. The thing is, when people hear the kind of headlines of this story, they quite often think, you know, what an idiot, you know, or do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah.
No.
I mean, oh God, when it all came out in the press, everyone kind of said, how stupid is this woman?
So we've sort of set the scene. So you've met this guy called William online. 2 weeks, I mean, it was absolutely motoring. At 2 weeks, 4 weeks, said he loved you. After 4 weeks, he asked you to marry you. You said no. How many times had you actually met up and seen each other? And when you said no to him, I'm just curious to know how you delivered that. Was it kind of like a, don't be so silly, but we'll see how we get on and maybe I will one day? Or was it, this is red flaggy and I don't want to marry you? Like, how was that?
Oh, well, actually, I mean, that in itself is a story. We were supposed to, it was the day before Christmas Eve on 2000. My mother was looking after my daughter because he and I were supposed to be flying down to London for a big party that his, you know, one of his clients was holding. Mm-hmm. So I was going to meet a whole load of his friends and stuff like that. And I'd sort of sat waiting for him to pick me up and getting texts saying, I'm on my way. And he didn't turn up. You know, so long story short, I drank an entire bottle of wine, went to bed, and just went, not acceptable. We're done, kind of thing.
And did he explain where he'd been and why?
He'd told me that he was an IT consultant, and he was at the time, you know, bearing in mind in the year 2000, computers were brand new, servers, internet, and all that's just coming out. And he said that he was in this kind of basement room, you know, sort of like one of his clients had their whole system had gone down, and he had to go and, you know, spent the whole night kind of fixing it, kind of thing. And initially he'd had service, but, you know, because he was in this basement thing, he'd stopped having service, so he'd stopped being able to contact me.
And I think this is an interesting point of your story as well, because we meet someone and trust them in good faith, we don't question what they tell us. But he did say, yeah, he's working in IT. As you say, it was a fairly new career. I mean, it's so different now, isn't it? But the career really was a huge part of his masking.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
So yeah, can you perhaps explain us a little bit about what you understood his job to be and what that meant sort of geographically, logistically with his time?
Well, at the time he was in, at that time when he proposed me, that was, as what I knew was he was working as an IT consultant. He had an office in St. Andrew's Square in Edinburgh and staff. And what his job was part of his job was to hack into people's company systems to see if they were hackable. That is, you know, sort of like he was basically an IT guru. He had a PhD in computing kind of thing. You know, it was, you know, he was really high up on that kind of list. Things evolved job wise. But at the time that he proposed to me, that I just knew him to be an IT consultant. And so when he finished that story, when he turned up at the house at 7 o'clock in the morning saying that he was sorry, I was dumping him. I was telling him it was over, right. Because I wasn't going to put up with somebody who just stood me up like that. That was not respectful. It was not, you know, to me, it was a clear indication that somebody didn't care.
And how did he take that piece of information?
He asked me to marry him.
In
that moment, whilst I was dumping him, he was like, but, you know, it's not that I don't care, you know. So, and he produced a ring on a teddy bear, you know, which at 7 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Eve, you know, he couldn't have bought then, you know, he couldn't have bought it that day as an excuse. It has to have been bought beforehand. And the whole thing about going to London was that he was going to propose to me and everything else. And I was kind of like standing with my arms crossed and my legs crossed, leaning against the cooker kind of thing, you know, sort of like in a very defensive, you know, not having this conversation, just completely blindsided me. And so the conversation became about, no, I'm not marrying you, instead of I am dumping you. It was a complete, you know, 360. And it wasn't like, oh yes, darling, you know, wonderful, yes, in a let's. It was very much, what the heck, you know.
Right.
So, you know, so of course I said no and just said absolutely not. But it also totally derailed my argument of, you know, you obviously don't care.
Right.
Because, you know,
it shifted the whole focus from you having your moment to then him pulling into, well, I'm going to sort of one up Trump with that. So, yeah. And did he accept no as an answer?
Yes, he did. He did say that he wanted me to hold on to the ring, you know, sort of like whilst I thought about it. And so that was the kind of, okay, you know, sort of like, and he never actually asked me to marry him again. He just, from then on, he was just like, this is my fiance, you know, and it just gradually over time, I just kind of, you know, accepted that. That sounds weird, but yeah, it was just, you know, it was that whole.
He sounds like, so just to put me back, and so he sounds like a very, dominant man, or quite very persuasive man. Was he like that?
No. Very. He was a geek. You know, he was a nerd. He was. You know, I mean, he was tall. He was mixed race. I'd say, you know, nice looking. I wouldn't say he was God's gift. He wore the most ridiculous glasses. You know, this kind of Air Force American, slightly rose tinted glasses, which is just rather odd.
But and the irony in that statement.
Yeah. But yeah, he was very quiet. He was never the loudest person in the room. He was always the person, but everybody wanted to talk to him. It was about 4 or 5 months in that I kind of accepted, I think, that we were engaged. I mean, it wasn't like we were planning the wedding or anything else, but it was just like, yeah, we were engaged.
Right. And so you felt he loved you, you loved him. Yeah. Okay, got it. Other than the standing up, was that the main presenting issue, this sort of random standing up?
Yeah.
Okay. So you go into Dr. Google, as I think we all do.
Which didn't do anything.
Okay.
But he had this company, which he was based in St. Andrew's Square. So I looked up the company, and there was a company secretary address, which wasn't his address. And I thought, that's odd, right? I don't know what, but it was in Gullen, so I decided to go and see this house. And I drove 45 minutes to this house, saw this big house, I mean, like 5, 6, 7 bedroom house with loads of antenna on the roof and big high wall around the garden and children's play equipment in the garden. And I was just like, he's can't have kids, so why is there play equipment in the garden?
Of course, you know, he said he was unable to have children because he had mumps. So hang on, so you've managed to locate his company address. Mm-hmm. You've gone to the company address and you're finding essentially a massive pad, a house with kids equipment. I mean, okay.
Yeah. So I texted him and just said, I didn't knock on the door. Gosh knows what the story would have been different if I had. But I didn't have the courage for that. I had the courage to go and see it, but not to actually knock on the door. So I went home, texted him and said, you need to come and explain. Or no, I basically said, you know, what the hell? You know, excuse my language, what the heck?
You can say what you like, Mary.
It could get very, very bad language.
Mary, this is your space to tell your story in whichever language you want. I think we can all forgive you the occasional blasphemy and foul and swear word, honestly.
So anyway, he appeared. He was, at the time, he was announced in the Times newspaper that had this job working for this company in Manchester. So he was working at the time in this company in Manchester. So he was working away. He arrived at my house within like 4 or 5 hours. So, I mean, he must have tanked it along the motorway to get there. He arrived and he said, it's not what you think. You know, I need to explain something, but I need to get permission before I can. You know, so can you just sit and wait? And I won't be long, but just, you know, hold off. I have got an explanation. Wow. And so I was just like, what the heck is going on? And I'm summarizing everything, obviously. So, you know, you've got to take all of this with a...
Of course.
There's a certain amount of time going on. Anyway, so I sat there listening to him walk up and down the hallway on the phone to somebody. And I couldn't really hear what he's saying, but, you know, sort of like, you know, there's kind of an intense conversation going on. And I sat there for about 45 minutes and I was sitting there just going, what is going on? Really confused, off balance. Anyway, so in those days, you had those little blue Nokia phones.
Yes, those ones I had one.
That came up with, they'll come up with a number, but their newfangled ones came up with a name, right? Oh. If you had it programmed into your phone. Now, this is brand new technology at the time. Anyway, so I was sitting there and my phone started to beep, SIM update. And then it started saying MOD relay, right, on this little screen on this Nokia phone. And I'm just going, what is going on? It was just so confusing. And, you know, sort of like I'm sitting waiting with anticipation for exclamation. Anyway, he came in and he sat down and he said, I'm going to tell you something. Sit and listen to it. You can ask me questions at the end. Everything I tell you is going to be proved in time. But please just hold off and listen to the whole thing, right? He then went on to explain that, yes, he did work in IT. He was an IT nerd. He was an IT specialist. And he did work for his own company, but he also worked for the ODCI, which is the Official Department of Central Intelligence in America, which is more commonly known as the CIA. So he wasn't a spy. He was the guy in the van. He was, you know, it was just a job. It wasn't, you know, sort of like that. There wasn't any kind of mystery or spy or any, you know, it's just basically that he had a weird employer, that he was recruited straight out of university because he showed such aptitude for computers. And they were, you know, they knew that computers were going to become a huge part of the intelligence services. So, I mean, the suspension of disbelief was there. So I'm kind of like going, I have no idea. This does not, you know, this is just too bizarre.
But also as well, listening to it from you now, I'm going to be totally honest. I'm in. Why would this not be true?
Yeah. So he sat there and talked to me for like hours on end about the, you know, how he was recruited. He also opened his laptop and showed me the ODCI website, the CIA website.
He was on it, don't tell me.
Not on it, not featured on it, but he showed me into areas, you know, sort of logged in and showed me things, you know, etc. I mean, that was the first thing. He then, you know, over the next coming months and years, he carried a gun. He had money packets paid with that were had sealed with MOD. Now, when he was away, when he was called away somewhere, I got a phone call from somebody else saying, just to let you know, well, Jordan's been called away. He will be in touch as soon as he can. When, you know, sort of like all sorts of things. So there were people verifying his story. There was
actual people, like actual people you'd actually speak to, not just messages. Actual people.
People would call me and say, just to let you know, but different people, you know, would call me and just say, so, you know, just to let you know, just relaying a message, you know, for, well, Jordan's been called away. He'll be in touch as soon as he can, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So now he didn't stand me up. I was now included, you know, and all these kind of things. And all the time, you know, there's still this suspension of disbelief. So moving on, so we did start talking about getting married and started sort of planning and preparing for it in the summer of 2001.
Had you ever met any of his friends and family at this point?
No, we had an engagement party, and, you know, because he traveled around all the time, you know, his friends were, you know, dotted all over the place. His parents were, he's American, so his parents were from New Jersey.
Right.
And they flew in for our engagement party. And then had an argument at the airport. You know, his mother was, as he explained to me, his mother was bipolar and not very well. And she had a meltdown in the airport, and they literally got on the plane and went straight back again. So,
did you see them?
No.
Ah. Uh-huh.
So I spoke to them on the phone. So okay. I did speak to them on the phone. In the summer of 2001, when we were thinking about getting married, we were planning the wedding. We had sent out, or we hadn't sent out invitations, but we told people the date, you know, things like that. Mm. I found out I was pregnant.
What?
And this was, yeah, very shocking. And told him that that was the case. When I told him, you know, that all the colour drained from his face.
Well, he told you he was infertile.
Staggered back to, yeah, he said it was an absolute miracle that, you know, he was told that it was a 1 in a million chance he would ever have children because this mumps as a child. You know, this was a miracle child, you know, and his parents phoned me to say how utterly delighted they were to, you know, and we had a group call with him and his mum and his dad all on the phone at the same time. And they said, you know, how delighted they were that they were going to have a grandchild, you know, and that this was their first grandchild. And they were so, you know, because they thought they were never going to have any grandchildren. And so, you know, I had spoken to them, and I did sort of like, I was in touch with his mum via email and stuff like that.
And had any of your friends and family met him?
Yes. By that stage, you know, most of my friends and family had. My parents and my siblings had met him, you know, and they all liked him. My mother was always suspicious of everybody, but, you know, that's mothers. We were going to get married, you know, sort of like looking at wedding dresses and everything else. And then he was called away. And he was called away to the Palestinian territories. And so he was gone for a couple of months, and they came back for a visit, and then he was gone away again. So the whole of the pregnancy, I hardly saw him. When it
Did
came
you speak to,
to
him?
Yeah, we were talking via satellite phone. And he, at the time, and I know this is very politically sensitive at the moment, but at the time he was in, there's a town called Jenin in the Palestinian territories, and it was surrounded by the Israeli troops, and they were literally bulldozing houses, you know, going inwards so that, you know, people were trapped in the middle. And he'd gone to try and set up, you know, internet capability basically and stuff like that. So, and he got trapped in Jenin for 3 months. When he came out, his feet were mangled. I mean, because he hadn't been able to take his socks and shoes off for like, I don't know, months. And so they were like mangled and cracked and, you know, black and bruised. You know, so when he came home, you know, Ailey had been born. She was a month old, I think, by the time he came home, and he met his daughter for the first time. And he was just absolutely besotted. But, you know, he was also very thin, very pale. You know, he was very disillusioned with the service. He wanted out. He didn't want to do it anymore. He wanted to be at home with his family. So he, you know, sort of like he set about trying to get out of the service, which wasn't as easy as it sounds. We had a sort of couple of years of him working in private contracts. He did a job for Microsoft. He did a job for the BBC. Very, very highly paid. I mean, when he was working for Microsoft, he was getting like £10,000 a month. And
Was he at this time then? Were you living together full time, or was he still going away for chunks of time?
All the work he was doing, like with the BBC, was in London, so he was always away. But you know, he came back for weekends and stuff like that. But it basically, you know, it became life. You know, him being away and coming back. You know, sort of like it was. I mean, when he was home, he was absolutely brilliant. You know, he was great with the kids. He was, you know, he was marvelous with Robin. You know, he was just very loving, very sweet. He would do the hoovering and the cooking and, you know, everything when he was home, you know.
Right. And your relationship together was intimate, very romantic,
very intimate, very loving, you know, sort of like whenever he was home, you know, we made the most of it. You know, we very, very loving, you know. And just, you know, when he was away, you know, there was constant texts and stuff like that saying, you know, when he was able to, saying how much he loved me and everything else. It was very, you know, he was very supportive and very, you know, he said and did all the right things. Do you know what I mean?
So bring us into the next part of the story.
So what happened next was, well, now he'd realized that he could have children. He wanted to try again. So we were trying for another child. And he was working at Microsoft, and things turned very dark in 2004.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
So what happened was he explained to me that whilst working for Microsoft, now under his own name, with his home address, with his wife and his family, somebody who he had been involved in a undercover operation with insurgents, the kind of people who brought down the Twin Towers. He had, whilst working at Microsoft, recognized somebody else from that operation, from the other side of the insurgents. So they had recognized him, and he had seen that his personnel records at Microsoft had been looked up. And they had started blackmailing him and saying that they were going to, they now knew his own address, his home address, his wife and children, and that they were going to kidnap our kids and rip bits off them and send them through the post unless we came up with money. I also got pregnant again, and my son was born on the 1st of April 2005. By the time my son was born, I had nothing left. I had nothing. I was going around to my mum's house and my friends' houses when I knew they were going to feed the kids, because I knew if we were there at the doorstep, they would actually feed my kids too.
Oh, Mary.
That's how bad it was. Gosh, I was diving down the back of couches, you know, finding money to get milk so I could at least give them cereal in the morning, kind of thing.
And what was he saying about this? What was his...
That he was doing, I mean, I was by this stage completely sucked in and, you know, sort of like believed that he was the only person I could trust, the only person I could talk to, the only person I could, you know, I couldn't, anybody else that I talked to about the subject, I would be putting him in danger, as well as myself and the children and the person that I talked to. I'd be putting them in danger as well. But I wasn't sleeping either. I mean, every night he brought me a taser so that I could defend myself against these people if they broke in, because of course he was away. Mm. You know, so I was putting on a mask for everybody else. Nobody around me knew what was going on. Not my
nobody
siblings,
at all.
Not my friends, not nobody.
Nobody had a clue.
I was talking to. No.
Wow, gosh,
man. So stayed with my mum for a while. I did get a flat somewhere else, in fact just a block away from my mum's, which was amazing. So my mum was my best friend, you know, so she was an amazing person. And then we come to the 5th of April 2006. So summarizing what happened in the previous year, he was arrested, and this is where it gets very long and complicated, and it's trying to explain what happened. He was arrested, but he was arrested for, he said, you know, it was basically the CIA was still really pissed at him for leaving. And so they kind of done these sort of trumped up charges.
So he was arrested, but would you say for kind of convoluted crimes to do with his job and all a bit sort of CIA?
Yeah. He was actually, at the time, he was working for John Prescott, the Deputy Prime Minister.
Okay.
Right? As an IT guy.
I
but
mean,
again,
Mary,
you know.
I feel like I'm hallucinating right now with all this. And this isn't even my life. Okay.
Well, he really was working for John Prescott.
Oh, okay,
I'd been into his offices and everything, okay. You know, so like, this is another thing that all the things that he did that, you know, sort of like, that was true. So we had to kind of, the police called me and they said, where is your car? And I said, my husband's driving that car, you know, sort of like, and they went,
were you married?
And hung up. Yeah. We got married in 2002.
So you were married at this point. Okay.
We had got married. Yeah. In 2002. So Ailey was born in February, 2002. We got married in October, 2002.
Right.
Just skipped over that bit, didn't I?
No, that's I mean, there's a lot. We're bringing it. Are you keeping up, listeners? We're in. So the police ring you, okay.
And I said, my husband's driving a car. And they just said, thank you. And that was it. That was in conversation. And that was the only time Will ever called me angry. That was the only time I ever heard him angry. He was like, you don't know what you've done. And I was like, you know.
What had you done?
You know that you're never supposed to tell anybody anything. Well, you know, you're sort of like, what do you think you've done? And I kind of like, well, just told them that you were driving the car. I don't understand. He was arrested, and you know, he said it was all trumped up charges, that he was going to court on the 5th of April 2006. So on the 5th of 2006, I was waiting for the phone call from his female lawyer, and I was getting.
Was he in jail? Was he on remand?
No, he was on out and bail,
out,
waiting,
out, right,
waiting,
yeah.
So I was waiting for this. So I knew he was going to court that day. I wasn't going with him. And we went and I was getting the kids ready to go to the library or something to get a book, and I couldn't find a shoe. And I just remember that kind of like, oh, you know, sort of like one of those mornings, you know. And the phone rang, and this woman, she said, are you Mary Turner Thompson? And I said, yes. She said, are you also Mrs. Jordan? And I said, yes. And she said, I'm the other Mrs. Jordan. And I said, she explained to me that she was married to him. She had been married to him for 10 years longer than me. She had 5 children to him. Her nanny had 2 children to him. We knew that 3 of those children were the same age as my 4-year-old daughter. So both the nanny and the wife were pregnant when he wrote to me saying that he was infertile and couldn't have kids. And he was in that house that with all the kids' equipment where she and the nanny and the 5 kids and the 2 kids all lived. So he was a bigamist. And not only a bigamist, it turned out he had 5 fiancés at the time. He had, so 2 wives, 5 fiancés. We knew at the time of 10 children by several different women. There, we now know of 14 different children, and there's more likely to be about 40. Those are just the ones that have contacted me. And he is a total psychopath who is actively impregnating women to rip them off for money. That is what he does.
May we just take a pause?
I always find this part so funny because you are actually looking like you could pass out.
I mean, so for the context of listeners, Mary and I were on video. We're seeing each other. We can see each other. Well, I mean, like I say, I obviously, you know, knew knew the top line of this. But when you hear it unpacked, and you're brilliant, Mary. Like I say, you've been through this, and I know before we got onto actually recording the podcast, you know, you're so brilliantly stoic, and you said, "I've done the healing, Anna. You can ask me anything. Trust me, yes. I've been there. I've done it. I've gone through it all," and that's why you're able to talk so articulately.
Yeah, I've had 19 years to process this. Right, you know, right. You've only got minutes.
I've had 3 minutes. and as have the listeners. But so just to wind it back slightly, just to let that. Mm. Penny
sink in.
Drop and sink in. So this man, at this point, how long had you been together?
We've been together 6 years.
So you've been together 6 years.
Met in 2000 and this was 2006.
And yeah. You'd had two children together. You had another child as well. So three children in total. And he's about to go to court that day for some charges, whatever. And then you get a phone call from a random woman saying to you, "I'm the other Mrs. Jordan." She's a wife. She's also married to him legally. I mean, as you said, this is bigamy now. Yes. So she's legally married with children. The nanny has also got children with him. Yep. He has other fiancés, other children. I mean, good Lord. I mean, firstly, I mean, so many questions. How did she track you down? How did you come into her ether?
Yeah, she had found my number in a notebook, she'd had that for a while, but he had said to her that I was an asset. I was I posed as his wife for various operations, so I was a colleague, not actually another wife.
Well, so this is my other big question then at this point. So the job that he said he had, this going away CIA, MI5-y techie thing, was that real?
No, not at all.
So not what he did? That's not he'd given the same flannel to her and to the other women that's what he did. This was his one big cover story. What did he do?
It was a different cover story for each woman. So to his other wife, it was that he worked for British intelligence because she actually was married to a guy who worked at the Pentagon before married to him. So she,
I mean,
she,
as you do, you know,
so she would have been able to check him out if he had said he was CIA. So he told her he was working for British intelligence. So there was all sorts of, you know, and some of the. When we fast forward, some of the jobs that he told women he was doing was a pediatric surgeon, that he ran a medical records company, that he, you know, he was a pilot, that he was a, you know, sort of like a security guy, that, you know, he worked for the Foreign Office abroad, you know, all sorts of things, that different stories he told people.
So all the just complete fabrication. And when So the whole of your 6 years.
And he was conning the software company. He wasn't doing any work for them. He was just invoicing them for time. So, I mean, after 10 months of working for the software company and charging them £10,000 a month, you know, they realized he wasn't actually producing anything and got rid of him. And the same with the BBC, the same with all jobs.
So he was conning the job. I was going to say, so he was conning the job. So he was an absolute career criminal, con artist.
Yes.
My God, like, so, I mean, I'm fascinated with how this played out. So all the times that he was away, in inverted commas, he was, did you piece it together? He was at these other women's houses with their other families and other children.
I put a timeline together.
I was going to say.
With all the other women. So, in 2006, I think I found five of the fiancés and the other wife and I. And did anyone know?
Did any of the other women know that the other ones existed?
No. I mean, one of the fiancés had found a letter in his pocket addressed to Mr. and Mrs. Jordan. So she had realised that he was married and dumped him. But she didn't know about all the rest of it until, you know, that the basically when I went public, you know, it was in the press at the time, you know, it was quite publicly aware. And as a result, you know, a lot of people got in touch with me because I became the kind of public face of it. So I did, you know,
the poster wife.
Mm. And you know, that's when, you know, when I started writing the book, I asked these people if they would be happy for me to include their stories. So they said yes. They chose what name they wanted to have in the book. They got to read through what was before it was published as well. So in the book as well, there are some of these other women's stories. So
can I ask you, Mary? Because I was just sitting here thinking, now the penny is landing and dropping in me. And you're so brilliant at talking about it so articulately, and you've clearly processed it. And I know the writing has been a huge part of that yeah. process. But can I take you back to that moment where you found that out? You know, because here's, I'm just putting myself, you know, my human head on, my emotional head on. You were a wife who had lost everything. I'm sitting here now just thinking, oh my gosh, you've just been given this bombshell. This is your life. Literally your life. These are your children, your blood, sweat and tears of carrying and birthing alone these kids, you know, financially trusting in this man. And you can speak brilliantly about it now, I know. But how did you feel in that moment?
Relief.
Did you?
Yeah. Because at that moment, it meant that there weren't these shadowy people coming to hurt my kids. Oh. It was just him. And it's like by that stage, life was so tense and the psychological torture that he put me through was so bad that actually finding out that it was all him was like getting a get out of jail free card. I had taken my marriage vows seriously, you know, through thick and thin, through riches and poor, through sickness and health, you know, and I did not believe in breaking those real promises I had made. But as it turned out, you know, that wasn't a legally binding contract. It was, you know, I wasn't married to him at all. You know, it was all make believe. It's like realizing that you were married to Captain Jack Sparrow instead of Johnny Depp. I was going to say,
It's
the person I loved didn't exist.
How do you?
But I haven't told you the worst part.
There's a worst part?
There's a worst part. He also turned out to be a convicted paedophile.
Oh, Mary. So
knowing the truth and finding out the truth was, you know, the age of the girl that he had been convicted of, you know, it was sexual offences against a girl under the age of 12. So, oh, sorry, under the age of 13, beg your pardon.
Oh,
and my daughter, my sort of like his stepdaughter, was 7. So she was younger than the conviction that he had. I did get social services involved and I did get them to talk to her and to sort of check.
I was going to say,
and he hadn't ever touched her. He hadn't ever done anything.
Okay. This is absolutely, without a doubt, one of the most sort of weighty, dark experiences of infidelity that I know I've ever heard of. And that's saying something because I've been working within this genre for a long time. And thank you for being brilliant at explaining it, Mary, because I know that you're in a very strong position to be able to do that now, having gone through that process. And I don't at all take that for granted. I know what you must have gone through. So I guess my other big question now is, what about him? Did you speak to him?
I did, actually.
Stop. We need this conversation played out in full.
Well, I mean, his wife jumped in a car, drove up. We spoke for about 12 hours. And she left at about 6 in the morning. So the 6th of April 2006, she left. And I texted him saying, we're done. I thought dumping him by text was quite appropriate. So, you know, and he was just like, you know, no, you know. I mean,
did you tell him why? Did you not?
No, I didn't. She had actually said, don't let him know because I want to get the kids away before he finds out, you know.
As if it couldn't have got any worse. I mean, it really was bad. Now, this is a very dangerous man, a convicted sex offender. He's a serial bigamist. He's a career criminal. I mean, it really doesn't get any worse, quite honestly. Other than murdering somebody, I don't really see how he could have added to his repertoire anymore.
No, but one of his victims did commit suicide.
Oh, for God's sake.
So, you know, I don't know if that counts. But, he is an extraordinary, extraordinary psychopath. And he is a pure psychopath. He's not, you know, he's not just a bit of a bad lad.
Extraordinary. Yeah. And how, I mean, where is he now? Where is he now, Mary?
So he in 2006, he was convicted of bigamy fraud because he defrauded one of his fiancées. That's how the police caught him, because he used her credit card to pay for the car, to get the car repaired. The reason he was charged with bigamy is they'd asked me where the car that was in my name was, and I said my husband was driving it, but they found his marriage certificate to her in the car when they arrested him. So bigamy, fraud, firearms, because they also found the taser in the car, and not registering his address under the Sex Offenders Act, because he was due to do that for 10 years after his previous conviction. So he got 5 years. He did 2.5, and then he was deported back to the USA where he was from. Right. By the time he was out of jail, my book, which is called The Bigamist, had been published. I had done quite a lot of media by that stage. Within 6 months of him being deported, the first victim started contacting me from America, a woman who was pregnant and homeless because she'd given up her flat to move into this house that he'd said that when she arrived with her van or removal stuff, the people who owned the house turned around and said, "Don't know what you're talking about."
Oh,
so she had a 5-year-old and was pregnant and all her stuff in a van, and had given up her previous place and had nowhere to go. Mm. And I mean, again, what does he gain from that? Absolutely nothing, you know.
It's just an absolute trail of destruction of women and children, and it's just, I mean, I don't even have a word to describe it. It's so awful. So is he out now? Do you know? I mean, where are we up to now? Because I want to talk about how you've managed to get through all this, Mary.
Well, where I'm up to now is that the victim after victim started coming forward, more and more people. We now know of 14 children. I had a Facebook group with the lovely Michelle in America, who's like me. She's very public. She's very happy to talk about it.
Another
so
wife.
We've done. No, no. She was a fiance.
A fiance.
In America in 2014.
Sorry, all your children are related. They're all siblings.
Yeah.
Sorry, the penny's just dropped. Sorry, I'm still reeling from all of this. So, I mean, how do you feel about that? Your girls have got several other siblings. I mean,
the extraordinary thing is that Ailey has three siblings the same age as her, and the two girls and a boy, and the three girls, they look like triplets. They're extraordinary.
How close are they? The girls.
Well, they in age, they're all within 6 months of each other. So, but the children range from, at the time when I found out the truth, it was 35 to 1. So 35-year-old to 1-year-old. So, I mean, he had his first child when he was 18, I think.
Right.
So in America.
I mean, it sounds like you've created this sort of support hub. And, you know, I know you said when you started this too, like, I mean, have you had any more? Sorry, so many questions, but for the purpose of time, we'll have to wrap it up in a moment. Annoyingly, and revert to the book for the rest of it. But have you had any contact with him? Do your daughters know anything about this situation? And how have you managed to? What is it like now living a life where you've experienced this? I guess as a way of hope for others.
Yeah, I think, you know, writing the book was the most cathartic thing. You know, The Bigamist came out in 2007. It became, we've sold like 250,000 copies now.
That's huge.
And it's, you know, it's on Amazon, got like 14,500 reviews. It is, you know, sort of like, and The Psychopath came out in 2020 with all my research and all the new victims that came forward and everything else. Writing the book was the most cathartic thing I've ever done, so much so that I started a company called The Book Whisperers, which is a social enterprise that helps other people write their stories as well. I have a wonderful life. I help other people with the catharsis of writing. I do exactly what I'm enjoying doing. I'm still single.
Is that ship sailed?
Very
now?
Happily so. Very,
okay,
very happily.
Good.
You know, I had an amazing relationship with my three children, two girls and a boy, I should say, the last
Sorry,
one.
Sorry, of course it's two girls
That's
and a boy.
Right. I'm very happy. And it's you know, the writing the book has reframed the trauma. It's no longer trauma to me, which is why I'm so settled and happy on the other side of healing, because the story being out there, helping other people. I get letters still, I get 2 or 3 letters a week from people saying they've read my book and it's really helped them. So my experience is out there in the world doing some good, you know, yes. And as a result, it really kind of makes me kind of go, okay, well, it was 6 years of my life. I kind of see it like a university degree, 6 years of, you know, which was horrendous. But actually, the last 19 years, you know, has allowed me to do incredible things because of it, you know, and help so many people. And particularly, I'm a huge advocate for not victim shaming, and particularly not victim shaming yourself.
I can see how genuinely happy and content you are. Yeah. You're a wonderful mother of 3 amazing kids.
All adults now.
Oh, of course.
26, 23 and 20 now.
Do they know it all about this? And how so what do they think about this? Have they ever seen their dad since?
No. I told them at the time, because there's no way I was going to go public with the story without them knowing.
Of course.
So my 7-year-old and 4-year-old, 1-year-old didn't really listen, but that's not surprising. You know, told them that basically when they were naughty, I would make them sit on their bed and think about it. If an adult is naughty and breaks the law, then a judge will tell them that, you know, what they've done is against the law and puts them in jail. Mm. And that, you know, he had done that and he was deservedly in jail, not in anywhere bitter or nasty or angry.
Just factual.
One of the things that's so important, and it's such a strong philosophy of mine, which is we teach our children by example. Mm. And I had this opportunity, golden opportunity, to teach my children how to deal with adversity. And I certainly wouldn't tell them, be bitter, be angry, cry yourself to sleep over tonight, never trust anyone again. I had to live the advice I would give them because they would learn that by example, how to deal with adversity themselves.
Would you have done anything differently?
I wouldn't want to ever not have the children I have. So, and I think that I can't change what happened anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of like, I wouldn't be the person I am today if I hadn't been through it. So, yeah. But what I would change and what I do try and do is provide education for people. You know, in the books I've produced, I'm trying to show people the red flags. I'm trying to make sure that people have information that I didn't have, so that they don't get caught in the same kind of toxic relationship. And it's difficult, you know, it's really difficult because it is like, it's more like an addiction than it is like love. Mm. And it's really hard, you know, until the person who's in that relationship can see that that relationship is toxic. There's really very little you can do, except for keep the door open so they're not isolated. So they do have somewhere to go.
Yeah.
And do have a way out. But yeah, no, I wouldn't change anything really. It's like,
it's all brought you to here and it's brought you to us talking today. And thank you for taking your experience and turning it into something of legacy. And it honestly, Mary, I have so enjoyed talking to you today. I think I need to go and have a stiff drink. but I do wish you all the best. It sounds like you have a very fulfilled and love-filled life in the way that it serves you best now. And I wish you and your beautiful children all the best for the future. And, you know, everybody listening, please, once again, Mary, how can they get in touch with you and where can they read about your story in depth further?
So, yeah, I'm on Amazon. You can order the books from the bookshops, but it's also on Amazon. It's published by Little A, The Bigamist, and the second book is called The Psychopath. And so, yeah, very useful for knowledge and information. But the whole story is in The Bigamist. That's the how he did what he did, and, you know, sort of like the step by step.
Mary, thank you. I've taken up too much of your time already, but all the very best.
It's been fun. It's been really great talking to you.
Likewise, and I've learned so much, and thank you for just giving a lens into your life and your experiences. And my God, I hope nobody else has to ever go through that. But if they did, then they know how to guard against it. Thanks for your amazing wisdom. So, Mary Turner Thompson, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Affair podcast. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in today's episode, please see the show notes for organisations who can offer support and advice. Don't forget to subscribe so you are the first to know when a brand new episode drops. But until then, I'm Anna Williamson and this has been The Affair.
The Affair is hosted by me, Anna Williamson, produced by Naomi Channel, and is a Curve Sounds production.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.